This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back. This week we're going to stretch our minds into a developing future beyond any human experience. We'll talk to authors in the new genre of climate fiction, cli-fi, the classics and new writers. Right off the bat, we run into climate denial and the way the 1% control the rest of us. The show closes with a new study revealing estimates of the cost to fix climate change and why they're misleading, wrong, and a waste of time. That's just as the IPCC reports on the cost of reducing climate damage or letting it run rampant over the planet. The value of a living planet? Priceless. I'm Alex Smith, and this is Radio EcoShock. America has two political parties, but maybe it's just one party, by and for big corporations and big money. That may be the experience of our next guest. I'll introduce him with a quote from his own blog. Twice a surrogate stem cell spokesperson for the George W. Bush White House, J. Perry Kelly, ended his association with the political right over its distortion of global warming. Having witnessed the psychology of worldview exploitation firsthand, he spent 4 years crafting Quantum Fires, The Sibyl Reborn, a psychological thriller. James Perry Kelly, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. I'm glad to be here.
Well, naturally, I want to talk to you about your climate fiction book, Quantum Fires. But first, let's backtrack a bit to your path through the Bush White House and the early days of conservative climate denial industry, I would call it. Let's start with this. Why did you become a spokesperson on the stem cells issue?
What happened, Alex, was I was paralyzed in 1997 by a spinal cord injury, and I spent several years studying spinal cord research. And that led me in 2002 to very strongly question claims that were being circulated in the media and before the U.S. Senate about the medical potentials of embryonic stem cells and human cloning. And because I'm paralyzed, because I'm neither a Republican or a Democrat, or I don't have any religious views, I was considered, I guess, an attractive spokesperson for the people that were morally opposed to embryonic stem cells and human cloning, because they could wheel me into Senate chambers or before committees or before the media, and I didn't appear to have any agenda. And actually, I didn't have any agenda. My only agenda was I wanted to walk again, and I wanted other people to see hope in the course of their lives for their medical conditions. That's how I initially got involved, but I'm afraid it was a very disturbing and eye-opening experience to see how worldview agendas end up corrupting the political issues and the issues that confront mankind.
Well, that's your critical point, really. I mean, whatever listeners think about stem cell research, pro or con, our views and the whole debate can become part of a larger corporate and political plan. How can bias be exploited?
You know, that's the thing. That's exactly why I wrote The Sibyl Reborn, because I realized through my stem cells exposure to worldview policymaking, which is what happened with stem cells, I realize that people are very vulnerable. The public is very vulnerable because we have an aspect of human nature or human psychology that scientists at Emory University call universal. It's the tendency of humans, and it doesn't have anything to do with our IQ or academic training or professions or worldview. They say that everybody is very prone to this, and that is that humans will rationalize their interpretations of reality to fit their existing worldviews, their egos, their beliefs, or even their ambitions. And because of that, I realized through stem cells that people, the public, was exploited and divided by being told two different stories that conformed with what the public wanted to believe. And then, if that wasn't bad enough, in 2006, I realized that the exact same people that I had once considered my allies at the national level, in government, in the Congress, and in the White House, and whatever, I realized they intended to do that same distortion in terms of trying to divide, keep the public divided, and distort the issues with climate change and global warming.
Right. They keep saying there's a debate. Well, scientists say there's no debate. This is what's happening. We've got the facts and the figures. So there you are, fairly deep in conservative organizations during the Bush years, as scientists raise louder alarm bells about climate change. What did you see happening?
Well, what happened was I wrote for several conservative blogs and newspapers or journals for their online editions. I have several articles that are still available on Human Events and the National Review. And what happened was I saw that my fellow writers or the correspondents for those journals, especially Human Events, were denying the existence of global warming and certainly denying that the man was causing it. And I became very upset because I realized that the whole idea of using worldview division to keep society divided and to paralyze its efforts to not only protect itself but to improve the world we live in, and in this case I'm talking about global warming and the fossil fuel causes of global warming and climate change, I realized that they intended to keep society divided to serve their masters in the industry.
Last week and recently on Radio EcoShock, we talked about two organizations, CFACT and the Cornwall Alliance, and they reportedly received donations from big oil and coal as they attack environmentalism and specifically the campaign to halt climate change. Did you run across anyone who was involved with the Cornwall Alliance?
Yes, I did. What happened was in 2005, I was a featured speaker, I should say, for the Family Research Council's Washington Briefing, it's called. It's a major fundraising event in Washington that they hold every year. And their spokesperson, or I should say their president and founder, his name is Tony Perkins, was a speaker and a supporter of the Cornwall Alliance, and also one of the people that I corresponded with daily for almost 5 years as part of a biotech policy group of conservative advisors, was also a major speaker and supporter of the Cornwall Alliance. And that was one of the things that very much I felt betrayed and ashamed of my former activism when I saw that my allies had joined the Cornwall Alliance.
Do you think it's possible that big business can turn this global warming discussion into directions where they win even if the future planet loses?
It's obvious that's exactly what they intend to do.
Well, how can these sophisticated spin masters use our personal feelings to further causes that are actually against our own best interests?
As I mentioned before, the researchers at Emory, Drew Weston, PhD, who is the head of the psychology department, he found that humans have a tendency to interpret whatever they're told or whatever they hear so that it supports their existing worldviews or beliefs or comfort, convenience, egos, whatever. And that's what happens. You have people that are staunchly conservative or staunchly liberal, and they're told by industry, by the media, by politicians, by whoever, they're told things that agree with what they want to believe. Not necessarily agree with what they believe, but what they want to believe. And I say this because, for example, this is just for an example, in the stem cell debates, the public was led to believe that the conservatives, for example, were led to believe that the liberals who were in support of embryonic stem cells and human cloning didn't care about morals, didn't have any ethics. You know, all they cared about was using embryos and fetuses and whatever as a means to an end to develop cures, miracle cures, whatever else, and also to support these biotech industries and the pharmaceuticals and whatever. Okay, but on the other hand, the liberals were led to believe that anybody who opposed embryonic stem cells and human cloning must be a religious zealot that was willing to have people suffer and die for the sake of their religious values. So what you had was you had both sides of society, you know, especially the extreme sides, were willing to believe the worst about the other side because it told them what they wanted to believe. And the same thing is happening with global warming and climate change.
Did this experience in the world of public relations and politics push you to write your first climate fiction novel?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, what I did when I wrote the novel, it was my novel, The Civil Reborn, is my effort to expose the strategies that are used to keep society divided and to paralyze positive action, especially with climate change and global warming. And the reason why I say that is because what I did was I based the novel on the psychology that's used to exploit us all.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm speaking with James Perry Kelly, author of the cli-fi novel Quantum Fires, The Civil Reborn. James, why don't we dissect that title in two parts? First of all, what is the quantum fire?
Well, originally I meant to call it Quantum Fires, and The Civil Reborn would have been the first episode, or the first version or the volume of it, to make it into possibly a trilogy. Actually, the book is only called The Civil Reborn now. I got away from the Quantum Fires. I think what I'll do is I come out with a sequel and then another sequel beyond that. I will call the series Quantum Fires, but the initial book itself is called The Civil Reborn.
Fewer people have a classical education these days, so you may have to explain who the Sibyls were in ancient Greece.
Well, it's not actually the Sibyls themselves. It's one prophetess by herself. her name was Cassandra, and she lived in a city called Troy 3,200 years ago. And she's been famous ever since then because she supposedly had a curse that caused anything she said to be ignored or laughed at or scorned or denied by anyone that heard it. In other words, no matter what she said, no matter how true, she was always laughed at or scorned and never believed. And so I thought she would have been the perfect person to reincarnate in a novel to be the voice of climate change and global warming, because, of course, she would still be denied. And so the novel is actually my effort to strike back at global warming deniers.
And you talked about this study that found a flaw where we interpret everything to fit our own views. And you call that in your book, you call it the taint. And it seems almost like an original sin. Is it really a flaw in our operating system that you're describing?
I'm afraid so, because if you think about it, we're, as a species, we have to rely on our ability to objectively evaluate reality. Because obviously if you're out there and there's a 500-pound lion and he's chasing you, you have to be able to recognize it's time to turn around and run and maybe, you know, climb a tree or start a fire or do something. And if we as a species cannot objectively assess our reality and decide what we have to do, if we make it what we want it to be, which is what we're doing with climate change and global warming, as a species, we're certain to eventually self-destruct.
Well, that was one of the origins of science, really, was that after centuries of long religious belief and some of them rather strange beliefs about witches and things, the early scientists said, we've got to have some way of measuring this in reality and started to form the tools to do that. I want to move on to another theme in your novel, and that's that humans are really aliens banished to this prison planet. It's a popular meme on the net. It's a thought that's centuries old, and it's made popular in modern times by the award-winning science fiction novel Chthon, I think it's pronounced, by Piers Anthony back in 1967. Out of curiosity, James Kelly, is this part of your fiction novel, a part of your structure, or do you hold that belief personally?
You know, I don't know about if I hold that belief personally, but to a certain extent, I think I do. Because if you look at humans on the planet, well, there's nothing else like us here. For one thing, if you look at evolution, the whole idea with evolution, there's several very big gaps. I mean, humans came along, we were something called the Peking Man, and, you know, we looked like we were very much primates, some kind of apes or monkeys or something like that. But all of a sudden, bang, over 100,000 years or so, we seemed to change to a much more human structure. So I'm not saying that humans, I think, were dropped off here as humans a long time ago. I think that there may have been, at some point, some type of genetic manipulation of existing species with an alien culture. I especially say that because, if I don't know if you've ever seen this or not, Alex, but have you ever heard of Nefertiti?
I have heard of the classical Egyptian person of that name.
In anthropological digs, they've dug up people, her picture, if you look at her picture and her depictions that they've found in tombs in Africa, her head is like, it's ungodly, it's like 18 inches tall. And it goes to a point, and they found human remains in Siberia that have the same thing. These people, these humans from a long time ago, were actually surgically adapted to their head is much larger than it's supposed to be. It's developed to a point that's like 18 inches tall. And what I've read about this, the scientists say, well, they must have had some kind of a religious rite or something like that to do this.
We're way, way off topic here, but I'll just toss this into the pool that, you know, people in China used to bind people's feet to disform them. And when you're first born, your skull is very, it's not finished forming and it's very flexible. Maybe they found a way to bind skulls to make them grow into odd shapes. But let's get back to the deal here. All right. Now, the thing that bothers me is the whole idea of the prison planet has been so abused by people like Alex Jones and L. Ron Hubbard. That's the secret of his Scientology theory, you know. But on the other hand, it's an old religious idea, going back to classical times, that we are imprisoned in these fleshy bodies because of our sins.
When I tried to come up with the Civil War Born, with, you know, the quarantine, actually, instead of a prison, I kind of tried to make it more like a quarantine. And the idea is that, I don't know, it's kind of esoteric, I guess, but what I thought was that it's one thing to point the finger at society now and say, hey, you're all defective, okay? I mean, a lot of people aren't going to want to believe that. It's not a very popular thing to try to get out there. So I thought, well, the thing to do is say that, hey, we were defective on another planet, and we were causing climate change and global warming on another planet. So we were kicked off there for the defect that caused it. So, of course, you know, it only stands to reason that sooner or later, after we've been here long enough, we're going to get to the point where we're going to do it here again.
You describe the taint as our deadly flaw. And one thing that I really found fascinating about your book is that we have embraced that flaw as our anthem practically here on Earth. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes, I do. It's not just politics. It's advertising. It's religion. And I'm not anti-religion, and I'm not anti-advertising or anti-politics. It's just that so many different areas of our society and of the human civilization use the fact that humans believe what we want to believe. And so we're led by people that are equally prone to believing what they want to believe, and they use the fact that, you know, we're going to believe them because, you know, they're telling us what we want to hear. And it's across the board. I mean, it's not just things like global warming or stem cells or Obamacare or anything like that. I mean, it's things like whether or not we poison ourselves with the things we put in our mouth, whether or not we, it's just every aspect of our lives is somehow or other, I hate to use the term I use in a book, but it's actually tainted by the fact that we're willing to believe what we want to believe. So it determines how we spend our money, how we spend our time, who we believe, who we trust. It's literally, if you look down through history, I mean, with the World War II, with the Nazis, things like that, it's determined the course of our civilization.
Yeah, well, you know, just looking at a small little example, I take an apple. I'm feeling kind of lazy. I don't want to wash it. And I think to myself, well, corporations wouldn't leave a lot of spray on this, would they? But indeed, they would.
Yeah, you're right. That's exactly right. Because we tell ourselves what we want, whatever's convenient.
Yeah. James, have you experienced climate change personally?
Yes, I have. I grew up in Pennsylvania. And I used to hike the Appalachian Trail. And, I mean, for years, you know, back in the, I mean, I'm 57 years old. So I grew up in the 70s and 80s and 60s even. And, you know, a hot day was the mid-80s. If it got up to be 90 at any time during the summer in western Pennsylvania outside of Pittsburgh, I mean, that was a hot day. But then later when I moved out over to Harrisburg, I used to see, Alex, I lived on the Susquehanna River Valley. And I used to see the smog just roll up from Washington, D.C. and the whole metropolitan area down there in the northeast. And it would come up the river valley, and it would hang like a pall for months on end. And it was so hot and so humid. The trees would wither and die. The leaves quit turning colors in autumn. They just withered and died. It looked like the blight from shale gold or something like that, you know, from mortar, I guess, you know. But, yeah, I've definitely seen it. And, you know, between the temperature and the way the earth has been just wilting, It's horrendous.
Do you have suggestions for ways people concerned about climate change can support writers and artists trying to get that message out?
Well, cli-fi is a great new genre. There's no doubt about that. That was coined by Dan Bloom, who's a literary theorist and also an environmentalist and also a reporter. But even not just the readers, not just readers supporting climate fiction, cli-fi, but also the authors. If the authors would embrace that as a way to bypass what I hope to do with cli-fi, which is why I wrote The Civil War Reborn rather than becoming a climate activist, was I hope to bypass denial through what's called suspension of disbelief. You try to suspend disbelief through fiction, and I hoped through fiction, through The Civil War Reborn, to bypass climate change denial.
Is there anything that I've missed? Is there something else that you would like to talk about?
I tell you, the only thing, Alex, is I was so flabbergasted, so disgusted that I ever supported the Bush White House, because, you know, when I was so involved with stem cells, here's the thing. I was as guilty as anybody else. I was so obsessed over what I called my pro-cures activism and studying science, biotech issues, that I didn't even know anything about him and Dick Cheney undermining the EPA, absolving big oil of having to have the sonic shutdown switches, which directly contributed to the disaster in the Gulf. I was in my own little, you know, world. I didn't pay attention to the bigger picture. And I really appreciate what you're doing here, everything you do, actually. And that's just it. I'm disgusted, and I only hope we can get past our division, our worldview division, and those who try to keep us divided to be able to see where we need to go as a species and man, what's ethical, regardless of what your worldview or religion is.
Yes, we've definitely got to get past this left-right thing, because climate change doesn't care about your politics or your religion. It's just going to sweep us away with rising seas and all that sort of thing. We've been talking with cli-fi author James Perry Kelly about his life experience and his new novel, The Civil Reborn. James, where can people find the book, and tell us where to find you on the net?
Well, thank you. The Subway Reborn is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Smashwords, and it's soon going to be coming out in an unabridged audiobook through audible.com. And I'm available. The Subway Reborn has its own website, and I also have a blog that's called Quantum Fires. And I'm available through that with my phone number, email address, whatever. I'd be glad to interact with anybody.
Okay. James Perry Kelly, thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate your help.
Fifty people have died in the Paris region.
And still there's no let up. France faces another stifling, sleepless night and a blistering day.
For me, it started in the 1970s with the Charlton Heston movie Soylent Green. It's people who are using art to describe our climate. I mean, a future that is 3, 4, 8 degrees hotter is very hard to imagine. No humans ever lived in such a world. Scientists can describe that, you know, with graphs, but artists may do it better. So we need climate fiction, now known as cli-fi. In British Columbia, Mary Woodbury is an author and organizer of the first recognized webzine about cli-fi. Mary, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
So how do you define cli-fi? What is it?
I have a loose definition of cli-fi. I say that it is fiction related to climate change. It can be literary, speculative. It can be science fiction. It doesn't have to be. A lot of it is set in the present day, recognizing climate change as we know it today. So basically just fiction about climate change.
All right. Now, I took a stab at why we need it, but why would you say that we need it? Why are people, you know, driven to write about this now?
Well, it's on the forefront of a lot of authors' minds. And I really didn't even realize when I was writing my own cli-fi book that it was a genre that so many people were writing and reading it. But now that I have learned more about it, I've archived almost 100 books at the cli-fi site. And I just realized that it's, you know, anthropogenic climate change is a relatively new idea amongst us in our generation. So the genre is just coming along with that.
And can you give us perhaps a better known example of a novel which depicts a possible future under climate change?
As far as a possible future, I would say Nathaniel Rich, Odds Against Tomorrow. Margaret Atwood's books are known a little bit in the cli-fi genre, but she's definitely popular and she speaks out quite a bit about climate fiction. Barbara Kingsolver is another one, although she writes not so much in the future as she writes in the present, but she's very well known in the cli-fi circles.
Yes, didn't she write one about the butterflies that didn't go to Mexico, they went to New England or something instead because the climate had shifted?
Yes, she wrote Flight Behavior, and the butterflies, their normal winter habitat was in Mexico, and they ended up in Tennessee, actually.
Did you ever see the movie Soylent Green?
Yes, I did when I was little.
Yeah, it's amazing. You know, it almost told the future that the cities were very hot, the countryside around them was all burned out, most of nature was dead, and then we discover the seas were dead as well. I think that should count as cli-fi.
Yeah, I do too. I agree. And there were some other books from the 1960s, for instance, by J.G. Ballard, where he was imagining a future of climate change. You know, maybe at that point in time, he didn't have the same knowledge that we do now. But for instance, The Burning World, which was, I think, from the early 1960s, the world was a big drought due to industrial pollution. And so, you know, he had the right idea, and he was writing climate change fiction back then.
I haven't read that, and I'm going to go and find it, because that sounds really interesting. Another groundbreaker for me was Bruce Sterling's 1994 novel, Heavy Weather, and he had talked to climate scientists. He knew, you know, what they were thinking, and it was set sort of in the southern United States. Texas was just dry and totally burned out, but they had tremendous storms and sort of like hurricane-like winds all the time. It was really very forward-looking. You know, the IPCC people would read it now and go, wow, how did he know all that?
I remember reading a book, this is unrelated to climate fiction, but it was about science fiction. You know, the whole idea behind science fiction is to create these scenarios where possibilities exist in, you know, in science as we know it or what it could be. And I actually read a book about physics, and it was kind of written for the layperson, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it right now, but it talks about how physics in comic strips and science fiction type of comic strips kind of laid the way for modern physics in a way, and it was really interesting, you know, and that's just what science fiction has done in the past, and it is interesting. In some of the older books, we look back now and say, you know, how could they have known? Well, maybe they didn't know exactly what was coming, but they were imagining scenarios that possibly are taking place.
Well, I can imagine there's a crop of younger writers taking on this theme. Can you recommend two or three that we might look at?
Yes. One of them is John Acheson. I just interviewed him recently and read his book called A Being Darkly Wise, which is not so much set in the future either. It's a present-day novel. And the author himself, I guess, used to work in the EPA, so he knows about all the red tape that the people in the U.S. have to go through to get environmental laws done correctly. And he writes about people like them in a fictional setting who follow this kind of mountaineer survivor type person to British Columbia. And the whole book is a philosophical look at climate change, among other problems that we're currently facing. But it's also an action-filled story, which is a great read. So there's, I think that's his first novel. And there's also Mindy McGinnis, who has recently written a young adult YA fiction called Not a Drop to Drink. And I'm currently reading it right now, and I really like it quite a bit. But I wanted to point her out because young adults, the climate change fiction for young adults is really growing too. So much that I actually added a special section on the website just for them because, you know, young adult fiction is growing in a lot of different genres, but climate change is doing so well with that.
And I can picture why that would be. I mean, you picture yourself coming out of high school, you're smart, you're reading, you realize that the future may be ruined if we don't change our way of living very quickly. So, of course, you're going to want to express that in some way, and I would encourage, as you're encouraging, young people to do that.
Yeah. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of Hunger Games in a way. That I think the reason that that series is doing so well in film is because you have young people, and it's nice to have the woman being the center star there, who are worried about their environment, you know, not just the physical nature that they're living in, but the social and economic injustices. And, you know, young people are inspired by seeing people doing the right things and leading the world into possibly a better place or a more fair place.
And you said you interviewed an author. Do you do that often? And why do you do these interviews?
I have interviewed a few authors who are writing climate fiction because I felt that people coming to my site would maybe get more of an in-depth understanding of where the authors are coming from. And I read once where, I don't remember who wrote it, but someone said that cli-fi authors were exploiting climate change. And I thought, no way, because I had talked to so many authors who are very intelligent, they care about the earth. You know, a lot of them are newer authors and they're not really making money off their books. They have something to say and they want to say it. And so I just wanted to let these authors have a place at Cli-Fi Books to talk about why they wrote their books. You know, I don't want someone else putting words in their mouth. I want them to say, this is why I wrote this book and this is what inspired me. And I think it just provides an extra layer of understanding for readers to know where the authors are coming from.
This is Radio EcoShock. We're talking with Mary Woodbury about Cli-Fi, and the website there is clifibooks.com, isn't that right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, now tell us about your own writing. You're involved in this personally.
Yes, I am. And I'm also a newer novelist. When I wrote my novel, it just came out of a deep concern about climate change and where we're headed in this planet. And I honestly didn't think I'd ever finish it. And even when I did and published it, I didn't even know about the genre at that point. And that's Dan Bloom, who coined the phrase cli-fi. Actually, I believe he knows everything there is to know about climate change fiction, and he found me on the internet. He found my book and started talking to me and said, wow, you know, look at all that's going on. And, you know, he's linking me to articles, and I thought, wow, this is really great. And I was getting a hint of other books that were written about climate change, but I couldn't really find a good resource for that. So that's why I created the Cli-Fi book site.
You know, Dan Bloom got in touch with me about 6 years ago. He had this idea for polar cities that, following what James Lovelock had said, that we'd end up sort of huddled around the Arctic Ocean because everywhere else would be too hot, that we would need to build cities in the polar zone. So he was picturing that. And I know that he's been following this for years, literally. He's living in Taiwan right now. He wrote me a nice email and recommended you. So what is the title of your book and how can people find it?
The title is Back to the Garden. I wrote it under a pen name, Clara Hume. There's another author with my name in Canada. And you can find it at Amazon. I archive it also at clifibooks.com. It's at also my press, which is Moon Willow Press, which is a small publisher in Coquitlam, British Columbia.
Okay, Moon Willow Press. Now, what if we have listeners with short stories or even books they want to contribute? Can they do that?
Yes, there's a book submission form at Cli-Fi Books that they can just fill out. It's pretty informal. It might take a week to 3 weeks for me to get it up because I like to research the book a little, maybe read the sample, just make sure that it's, you know, grammatically all there, and then at least has some good reviews.
And has there been much recognition from mainstream media or any recognition about this new genre?
There definitely is a growing recognition. The New York Times, NPR, Huffington Post, there's quite a few major, I think The Guardian too have talked about Cli-Fi. There's some smaller magazines such as Descent and Voya that have talked about Cli-Fi, my site in particular, as well as some of the books that I've mentioned. And I think it's something that's growing. And I just want to mention this, you don't have to include this, but it doesn't really have anything to do with climate change fiction, but I just watched this new series called Years of Living Dangerously that came out on Showtime Sunday night.
Oh, definitely, that's about climate change.
Yes, and even though it's nonfiction, I just think that that's going to be one of the breakthrough types of media to get through to people because it's really bringing, you know, the horrible parts of climate change that we're already seeing in the world into our living rooms. And I could not believe how affected I was when I saw some of the things that were going on. I think that fiction has the capability to do that. It has in the past. But, you know, we really have to just kind of get the public to know that climate change is real, that we're causing it. And I think once we get past that, more people are going to be reading climate change fiction with a more open mind, and instead of saying, oh, that's just a silly hoax, they're going to think, well, this is a real thing. Maybe this book will be interesting.
Yes, Years of Living Dangerously. It's a Showtime TV series. The first episode of it is available on YouTube. I just watched it last night, and it was a climate scientist, Andrew Glickson in Australia, sent me the link to it, said, you know, people need to watch this. Harrison Ford is in it, Tom Friedman from the New York Times is in it, and I think it's Don Cheadle is in it. And one of the things they're talking about is something that we covered in last week's show, which is the religious reaction to climate disaster seems to be that it's just God's will and there's nothing we can do about it, and an anti-science picture. So I'm just saying this for listeners who listened to last week's interview, that that's covered in that TV series. But I think getting back to the books, in my younger years, I know that my mind was really stimulated by science fiction. You know, Isaac Asimov and on, and Robert Heinlein and so on, long time ago. But I think science fiction is going to come back because we have these difficult problems that we don't know how else to express in any other way. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, I would definitely agree. I would maybe even argue that science fiction has never gone away, just from what I've been reading lately, because a lot of times Cli-Fi is discussed in the media as being like a subgenre of science fiction. So I've been reading quite a bit about both genres lately.
But it doesn't have to be science fiction to be Cli-Fi. There's other types of writing. Is that what you're saying?
Well, just for instance, Barbara Kingsolver's book, it has nothing to do with science fiction. I mean, it's, you know, it's set in the modern day. It's giving a scenario that's completely credible that could be happening. It's not science fiction. It's it's an example of climate change.
As we wrap up here, is there anything else you would like to tell us, and what would you like to see happen with your site and with this genre?
Well, with the site, it is sort of a hobby. I don't want too much to happen with it because I don't have the time to do more than what I'm doing now. But I do want people to realize the books that are there and to go look at the books and check them out. The books are organized by author. You can also just search for titles or search for, you know, YA fiction if you want. You can read interviews. I have some events and a couple articles there. These things will probably grow. And I just started a blog, too, where I talk about stuff like years of living dangerously and even nature writing as, you know, kind of a background to cli-fi fiction. So I want people to just understand it. It's not just a gimmick. It's not a gimmicky label, I should say. It is a real thing that people are writing about because we're faced with it, and people will probably be interested in reading climate fiction as well.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest has been Mary Woodbury, organizer at clifibooks.com and an author in the new genre of climate-based fiction, I guess we'll say. Thank you so much, Mary.
Thank you, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Top politicians, business leaders, and even environmentalists talk seriously about whether it will cost 2% or 10% of the world's economy to switch away from fossil fuels. A new paper says these emperors have no clothes. Estimates of the costs and benefits of limiting climate change are impossible. And that's according to a peer-reviewed study by Drs. Richard A. Rosen and Etteltraud Gunther. It's pretty shocking stuff when you hear what those official estimates leave out. Dr. Rosen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, first of all, I have to ask, who are you to question the complex work of whole teams of experts when it comes to the economics of mitigating climate change? Please tell us about your own background and that of your co-author.
Yes, well, my background is such that I've been an energy systems planner for about 35 or more years now. I've done a lot of detailed modeling work of the energy system, which, of course, is essential in analyzing climate change. And I've provided expert testimony and testimony in various federal lawsuits for the last 35 years. Even though I'm a physicist by training, I've been doing the economics of energy system work for, as I say, about 40 years now. My co-author, Dr. Gunther, is a tenured faculty member of the business school at the Technical University in Dresden, and she's also done a lot of work on scenarios and how scenarios should be put forth and uncertainty dealing with the future.
Well, before we get to specifics, do you think these economic predictions of the cost of avoiding catastrophic climate change are worth doing at all?
No, I don't. Not for the long run. I think that the modeling work that's been done, as much of the work that I did decades ago, should be focused on implementation of plans to prevent climate change. So over the long run, and for these models, long run means, you know, as long as 100 years or more, you really cannot make any scientifically credible economic forecast, or probably forecast of almost anything for that length of time.
Well, let's dig into this. I was truly surprised when I read your peer-reviewed paper coming out in the journal Technological Forecasting and Social Change. Maybe we should start with the models. They're called Integrated Assessment Models, or IAMs. What are they trying to do?
Yeah, well, it is very important to go back to the models and, in fact, the process under which they started. Most of them, as far as I know, were really geared to the IPCC climate modeling effort going back for several versions of the IPCC assessments. As your readers may know, or listeners, we're now up to the fifth assessment, and an assessment has been done roughly every 6 or 7 years over the past 3 decades. Now, these integrated assessment models are basically an attempt to link a very simple form of an economic forecast for the economy to the energy use of the economy, and also to the way land is used, because land can cause emissions of greenhouse gases. And basically, the attempt then is to, once you look at the greenhouse gas emissions due to economic growth or economic change, then the greenhouse gas emissions are then linked to a simple climate model, which produces a rough estimate of the temperature increase that will result from those greenhouse gas emissions. So when the models are called integrated assessment, it's an attempt to integrate economic forecasting with energy system changes, dealing with the burning of fossil fuels and what have you, to climate change and land use change.
Good. Now, that seems pretty clear. Now, if you come to me with an idea for a business or changes to an existing business, I'm going to require a business model with projections of what things will cost, and governments want the same. What's the harm of trying to provide that when it comes to climate mitigation?
Well, there's several different layers of uncertainty involved in trying to make these forecasts, as with any business, as you point out. The problem is that, you know, I doubt you'll find many businesses that actually make forecasts for more than about 5 years, maybe 10 years, in terms of input to their business plans. I've never personally heard of a business that forecasted for more than 10 years or so, and even oil companies don't do it for much more than about 20 years. But the first 20 years is almost not very important in these climate projections, because not much can or does happen in these model runs in the first 20 years. People are mostly focused on, as I say, at least 50, but primarily 100 years. They're mostly focused on what's going to happen to the climate by the year 2100. Okay. And the reason they're looking at that is because they want to look at the long run in terms of what's the, quote, best way to make investments to perhaps prevent climate change, what they call mitigate climate change. So the short run doesn't do much for you. In other words, forecasting just for the short run, 10 or 20 years, doesn't do much for these exercises, because, in fact, it's very hard to change the world much over the next 20 years. Most of the change is only feasible in the long run, and people look at various scenarios for the long run. And the kind of scenarios they want to create for the long run are things like what they might call business as usual economic growth throughout the world for the next 100 years versus various levels of investment to try to prevent climate change, to keep the temperature increase, say, to only 4 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Celsius, and in the best scenarios these days, about 2 degrees Celsius. So that's why they're looking at the long run, because the climate takes a fairly long time to change.
Now, I was really stumped when I read in your study that the models used for the Stern report and the 2007 IPCC report, quote, do not include any estimates of the likely future damage due to climate change at all. Now, does that mean things like the costs of Hurricane Katrina or the $60 billion for Hurricane Sandy is just left out of the model?
Yes, for most of the models, that's correct. They make no attempt to put what we call in the field damage costs in. There have been some integrated assessment models that have included damage costs in the past, but number one, they've been extremely simplistic, even more simplistic than many of these integrated assessment models that I criticize. And number two, they don't form most of the basis for the IPCC reports, because most of the literature is not generated from those models.
Wow. I mean, it seems like the violent storms, the rising seas, the droughts that could affect agriculture, those are one of the reasons we want to mitigate climate change, and yet they're not able to put those in the predictions. You point out another huge gap in this process, and it has to do with the inability to clearly state what the baseline we're going to use to compare with some future. Can you explain that problem a little bit for us?
Yeah, so in order to look at the economics of mitigating climate change, you're basically comparing two economic forecasts. You're comparing the economic forecast, what we might call a base case or reference case, where you assume that there are no major actions taken to prevent climate change. That's the base case. then you want to compare that to a scenario where you take major action, as I said earlier, perhaps in the best case to try to limit the temperature increase to 2 degrees Celsius over the next 100 years. So that's a mitigation scenario. So you have a certain cost each year for the mitigation scenario produced by the model. You have a certain cost each year produced in the base case with no mitigation options or actions taken. And then you just subtract the two economic results year by year, and you get the difference in the cost, or if you have negative costs, the benefit to mitigating climate change. So that's what you're looking at, the differences in cost between two scenarios out for roughly 100 years.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Dr. Richard Rosen from the TELUS Institute. We're talking about his new paper, The Economics of Mitigating Climate Change, What Can We Know? The other big gap seems to be if something that we didn't expect happens, the black swan events, perhaps there's a virus escapes and causes mass deaths, or we run out of oil. They don't even seem to consider peak oil. You talk about that, don't you?
Yes. Well, as I started to say earlier, and we should really discuss this a bit more, there are various kinds of uncertainty involved in trying to make projections for either a base case or a mitigation case. And many of them are neglected by the modeling community that runs these models for the IPCC studies. Now, one kind of uncertainty, as we just discussed, is that basically damage costs of the effect of climate change on the world are omitted. So that's a very big uncertainty. They assume zero is the answer, and clearly zero cost is not the answer. But another kind of uncertainty, as you say, is black swan, or very unusual events or low probability events that might have a very large impact on the world. In general, those are also completely ignored in these models. So for example, in the base case, when we have business as usual, it could be that we'll not run out of oil, but run low on cheaper sources of oil in the next 30, 40, 50 years. Actually, I think that's quite likely. But that kind of a peak oil type of argument is often ignored, because usually these model scenarios assume very modest prices for fossil fuels all the way out to the year 2100. They sometimes take into account that lower supplies will lead to higher prices, but usually the numbers are very modest. Another kind of uncertainty that comes in to these projections is just the basic uncertainties in all the technology costs that are involved to mitigate climate change. So, for example, I'm sure most of your listeners realize that solar photovoltaic cells are now coming into the market, and more people are putting them on their roofs or office buildings. Those generate electricity, of course, and they're what we call renewable sources of electricity. But what is the cost of a sort of solar photovoltaic cell going to be in 50 years or 100 years? I would argue we have basically no idea. No one knows. It's very hard to even project costs like that for 5 or 10 years down the road. The Chinese have made so many photovoltaic cells in the last 5 years that the cost today is far lower than anyone would have guessed just 5 years ago. So there are hundreds of assumptions on technology costs, the way technologies will work, what technologies will be available, in what magnitude will the availability exist. All these assumptions have to be made year by year, for every technology, for every region of the world going out for 100 years. So we maintain that just that level of uncertainty alone means that none of these economic forecasts can have any scientific credibility.
I'm not sure that I understood your points about energy efficiency. What are you saying in this paper about that?
Okay, well, energy efficiency, again, is a very important approach to mitigating climate change and to, again, making our economies more efficient. Energy efficiency means that we buy technologies that use less energy to accomplish the same task as the previous generation of that same technology. So, for example, under United States federal law, many appliances that we put into our homes have improved their efficiency tremendously since the 1970s. Refrigerators are one of the best cases, where the average of use of electricity for refrigerators to cool your food for the same size refrigerator has decreased by more than 50% since the 1970s. And many environmental groups and energy planning groups, consumer groups, argue correctly that improving the energy efficiency of all the devices that we use that consume energy is probably the first thing you should do to try to mitigate climate change. Just use fewer fossil fuels, use less of any kind of energy, and then there'll be less emission of carbon dioxide. So the first point to understand is that energy efficiency is usually almost your first consideration to mitigate climate change. And yet these integrated assessment models have a major weakness in their model structure and in the equations in the models because they don't have any detail about how to improve energy efficiency. They don't look at the costs and benefits clearly of investing more in more of energy efficient technologies and appliances. And they usually have very rigid constraints on the maximum amount of energy efficiency you can induce through price or other changes in these models, even over 100 years. So they don't look at the more serious scenarios that are quite possible where we implement energy efficiency much more quickly and comprehensively in the economy than has been the case historically.
And the other problem that bothers me is we're talking now about human systems, and it seems like we humans are co-evolving with another system that's in gigantic flux, which is the natural world, and partly due to climate change, it's changing. But other things, fishery scientists, for example, have predicted there'll be no important commercial fishery after about 2040, and we know species are going extinct. All sorts of things are happening in nature. How can we plug those into the models?
Well, it would be very difficult, but as we said in the beginning, those issues are really not plugged into the models at all. I mean, the models have very limited capabilities because they are already so complex, even though I criticize them for being too simplistic. So there's a real trade-off here between complexity and whether the model can actually run and produce an answer on a computer in a reasonable amount of time. So our interaction with the natural world, with animal and plant species, with the oceans, is not treated in the models. The only thing the models do take into account is roughly the rate of absorption of carbon dioxide into the ocean so that it falls out of the atmosphere. So that's taken into account to produce the temperature changes due to greenhouse gas emissions.
So you think the IPCC and government experts should just stop making these reports on the cost of combating climate change?
Well, again, we should be clear for your listeners that there are three reports that the IPCC produces each time it does an assessment. Report number one is on the physics of the climate change. That was released for this assessment back in September. So that certainly, I think, should go ahead because that's science and that's physics and chemistry and presumably one can do better over time as one see how the Earth evolves and climate change evolves. So I'm all in favor of continuing work on the physics and chemistry of climate change. The second report, which was just released about 2 weeks ago, is on what's called the impact and adaptation. So it's on the issue of what's the impact of climate change on the world, both the natural world, the ecological systems, as well as the human societies and human aspects of the world. That also, I think, needs to continue because we're learning a tremendous amount in those areas about how human societies have to adapt and cope and what needs to be done to prevent more damage to both the ecology of the world and damage to its humanity in terms of starvation and what have you. The third report is the one that I think is most problematic, which is about to be released in the next week or two. And that's the report that focuses on mitigating climate change and, in particular, the economics. So the economics is only part of the Working Group 3 report, but it's an important part. And what we conclude, as others have concluded in other published papers, we believe that the overall results for the economics, costs, and benefits of mitigating climate change for the next 100 years are, again, so uncertain. Uncertainty is so powerful here that those report. Those results on the economics should not be published because they're not credible. And we know we have to mitigate and prevent climate change anyway to preserve human civilization and to preserve the ecological systems of the Earth. So it's not like we need to find out that there are costs and benefits to mitigate climate change as a reason to go ahead or not go ahead. We don't have a choice. We must go ahead.
And I agree with that. And I think that's the final conclusion of your paper. It's not that it's not worth knowing this. It's just that no matter what it costs, we have to try and save the climate that we need to survive. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Well, the cost comes in the following way. As I say, 100-year projections of costs or benefits aren't relevant because we can't know them. We can't do it. So if we can't do something, then we can't depend on it for making policy decisions. But the cost should come in the shorter to medium term, as I started to say earlier, in terms of doing the best planning possible to mitigate climate change sort of on a five-year-by-five-year basis. So, you know, clearly we shouldn't ignore costs and benefits. We should try to be smart and implement those technologies that will mitigate climate change that are the least costly and the most cost-effective for society going forward every 5 years. But the point is that as we go forward, we'll learn more about the costs, more about the problems of implementing certain technologies, more about, you know, the acceptability to people of different technologies, more about how to implement them and the cost of implementation. And then we can, you know, adjust and fine-tune our implementation plans, you know, every few years, which is only sensible. So we need to pay attention to cost, but over the short to medium term, in terms of what's a smart way to go about mitigating climate change, not over the very long run, which can't be done and therefore shouldn't have an impact on our long-run thinking.
Our guest has been Dr. Richard A. Rosen from the TELUS Institute in Boston. The paper title is The Economics of Mitigating Climate Change, What Can We Know? Find links to Dr. Rosen and the full text of that paper we've been discussing in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Dr. Rosen, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Sure enough, the phony greens at the Breakthrough Institute told the press if it costs 6% of some imaginary future GDP to fix the planet and just 2% to wreck it, well, we might as well go ahead and trash the planet. Really, guys? So sad. Give up the numbers game and let's save ourselves and the rest of the species while we still can. Don't forget to follow up on all the links for this week's program and my Radio EcoShock show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. 10,000 people a week do it. And fill in the gaps with our past programs, always available as free MP3 downloads at the website ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening and caring about your world.